Peter himself is an interesting man. In the Gospels, Peter's the one who always seems to be in the forefront of everything. It's suspected that Peter was just a kind of person who was just ready to go. He was a man of action. He certainly was a man who often spoke up first, sometimes having to retrieve both of his feet out of his mouth because he was so forthright in saying things, he often said the wrong thing. One of the more interesting things that you see about Peter himself is the transformation from the Peter we see in the Gospels to the Peter we see here counseling people in the church. And one of the things that we see is a Peter who in the Gospels was usually ready to go and fight, now a Peter ready to counsel his fellow Christians to just sort of be patient and endure. Sometimes endure suffering. And a lot of what he says in his letter, particularly in 1 Peter, is about the suffering that the church in exile is going to have to deal with. It's not only a suffering from being persecuted by the community, in sometimes not so much big ways, but in small ways. But it is also a persecution and suffering, I should say, based on just the fact that faith is something that sometimes has to be purified. And in the first part of chapter 1, he talks about that. And he tells them at some point, you know, don't be surprised at that. You know, your faith starts out as one thing, but God purifies it along the way. And sometimes that's a little painful. Sometimes it's a struggle for that to happen. Well, as we look at what Peter is going to say here, I want to focus our attention on the specifics of what we have here in verses 10 through the end of the chapter, and that is verse 25 of 1 Peter chapter 1. And one of the things that Peter brings up in this section is he mentions the prophets of old. And he says about the prophets of old that one of the things that the prophets of old, perhaps either thinking about it, putting it in the forefront of their minds, or whether it was sort of something they knew in the back of their minds, he says they weren't just serving themselves. They were serving those who were to come after them. It's kind of like what we know about in Hebrews chapter 11, when the Hebrew writer talks about all the people of faith. He says they had faith even though they never really received what was promised. And perhaps that sometimes makes it hard on us. We kind of want to have some tangible results for our faith. Sometimes it doesn't happen. One such prophet was the prophet by the name of Amos. And if you're here this evening, I want to kind of give you a little bit more on the prophet Amos, about what he did, and kind of give you some suggestions about how you can read him. But about two generations before Israel, the northern tribes, were taken away into captivity, Amos was, although not raised as a prophet, was called to prophesy to the northern tribes in Israel. He was sent from Jerusalem, or from Judah, to Samaria. And one of the things that Amos did was condemn the hypocrisy and the injustice that he saw in Israel. He predicted that they were going to be destroyed as a result of it. But furthermore, one of the things that kind of moves Amos from being somebody in the past to someone who was predicting the future was, in Amos chapters 9, verses 11 through 15, part of the passage that was read this morning, he predicts that Israel is going to be restored. And part of the reason that he can predict that is because he knows that God is a God of redemption. And that God is a God of steadfast love. And that God has made a promise to bring about a restoration of Israel. And that particular theme is picked up, by the way, in Acts chapter 15, in the discussion that the church has when they're trying to wrestle with this whole notion of how do we assimilate the Gentiles into this church that was originally we had all these Jewish laws, and they had to figure out that, you know, some of those Jewish laws don't carry over into the new covenant. Well, James goes back to this passage in Amos chapter 9 to suggest that what is happening is, in fact, God restoring David's fallen tent. And he's doing that by bringing the Gentiles in. And so they could see that what Amos had done had an effect on them and was in fact what was being fulfilled with the gospel being preached and with the Gentiles coming in. And it kind of gives a pretty good illustration that Amos was serving a later generation as well as the generation in which he was in. Likely he had no idea what that prediction meant, or at least how it was going to be fulfilled. But he preached it anyway because he believed in God. He knew that God was a God of salvation and a God of redemption. And he looked forward for the sake of God and for the sake of Israel and for those he knew would come next. That's just what he had to do. He had to sometimes focus his idea on, I got to do this and it's going to affect the later generation. Future hope, I believe, still lives despite the fact that those earlier prophecies have been fulfilled. Peter gets the importance of this from day one. He understands that not only are these prophecies being fulfilled today, but it's going to affect a lot of other people later down the road. Listen to what he says in Acts chapter 2 and verse 39. For the promise is for you and for your children, and for all who are far off, everyone whom the Lord our God calls to Himself. Now there's at least a modicum, a small amount of understanding of the future in that. Maybe those who are far off, he may be thinking those who live in other places, but he at least understands that there's a generational kind of thing. This is for you and for those who are going to come after you. He raises the issue of the next generation. And he thinks immediately in terms of that, not just in terms of what's happening there. It's interesting that in the Old Testament, there's always been this notion of a drawing the past into the present and looking to the future. For example, when Israel was called to celebrate the Passover, they were supposed to tell their children, "We were slaves in Egypt." Now, that first generation could easily say that, "We were slaves in Egypt." But the next generations, in a way, they really did not experience it firsthand themselves, but they could still say, "We were slaves in Egypt." And so there's a past, a present, and still a future in what God was trying to do and in how they understood what God was doing. It was important for future generations to grasp the significance of that. Israel hoped always for future salvation and restoration. And so there's a very strong element of the future in what they said and what they thought about and how they were trying to look at their faith. By definition, this involved looking ahead. They always were hopeful for the future. And I think it does raise the question for us both personally and corporately, where do we want to be 2, 5, 10, or even 20 years from now? You know, it's good for people to stop and think about those things from time to time, isn't it? Because what we do now is going to influence where we are. My meager attempt here, my small attempt at a yogiism, you know what a yogiism is. It's one of Yogi Berra's statements that sort of sound kind of funny to you, but they, in a way they really make a lot of sense. Mine is, we must keep on our eyes on where we're going if we want to get there. I think Yogi Berra said it something more like this, and maybe his is better. If you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up there. You know, you have to sometimes think about that. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Well, I think that kind of helps us develop some sort of positive outlook and a hopeful vision of the future. Or what things might help us do that, maybe is a better way of kind of phrasing that question. Here's where we turn to a couple of guys on the road to Emmaus. A couple of guys who had been Jesus' disciples. And it's right after the resurrection. They've heard rumors that the resurrection has taken place. They're on the road. They've left Jerusalem and they're on this road to a town called Emmaus. And they're talking to one another on the way. And suddenly this stranger comes up to them and starts traveling with them. They do not recognize that the stranger happens to be Jesus himself. And one of the things that happens here is they start talking to him about what's going on. And they seem a little bit flabbergasted that this stranger, who's sort of toying with them, I guess, in a little way, does not seem to have any understanding of just what's happened in Jerusalem over the last few days. He really does, of course, because we all know that it's Jesus himself talking to them. And it's at that point, when they seem discouraged or seem perplexed about what's going on, that Jesus actually starts talking to them about it. And he tells them, well, how come you're so slow to believe all that was told to you? And then it says, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Well, the thing that's really significant about that is after Jesus disappears from view, after he just sort of vanishes before them, they say to each other, gosh, you know, when he was explaining all that stuff to us, weren't we kind of fired up? Wasn't there some burning that was going on inside of our hearts about what he was telling us and about sort of renewing the fact that we were, in fact, hopeful all these years and days that who this Jesus was really who we expected him to be, and he was convincing us through Scripture that that was really true? Didn't that just sort of get us fired up? Maybe that's what it takes just to kind of get us hopeful, to just remember that what Jesus said about himself was predicted in the past. It was carried into that day, and they saw it fulfilled, but it also still was able to help them look ahead to their future. And maybe that's a part of what sort of stirred them up, that it was so hopeful. The message was true, and it was extremely hopeful. And I think there's just times that we have to just stop and remind ourselves, you know, this good news really is true. And Peter's words, I think this is the connection here, Peter's words in this particular first chapter here that he's laying some foundation, I think sort of reflect the hopefulness that this good news not only is true, but it really is good. It really is good news. First of all, we want to notice back in 1 Peter that the first section of this letter ends with, I think, verse 9. Because in verse 9, he talks about the goal. And the goal is obtaining salvation. Salvation of our souls. That's our future goal. That's what we want to do. That's what we want to accomplish. And I think as a church, we kind of think, well, I kind of like to see more people do that, because we're sort of called to do that, aren't we? God calls us to bring more people in. That's the message of preaching the gospel. But it gives us a sense of looking to the future. It takes us out of the present only and sort of moves us ahead and says, all right, we've got to remember what our goal is here. And if my goal is salvation, it's going to say to me, well, there are some things that I'm not going to do because that's not going to get me to that goal. Not the least of which is I better avoid sinning. You know, I better stay out of the traps that we often get into in this life, because that's not my goal. It's not what I'm trying to do. But listen to some of the other things that he says here. In verse 13, he talks about setting our hope on grace. Clearly, a reference to the nature of God and to the mercy of God, so often touted in the Old Testament. We saw it, or we heard it in Psalm 116 that was also read this morning. The mercy of God. We set our hope on that grace. It's not necessarily our hope in how we see the political landscape unfolding, because that sometimes isn't hopeful. I was talking with Steve a little bit this morning about the economy and the number of jobs that have been lost. Well, that's kind of tough, but we really don't set our hope on the economy, do we? As good or as bad as it can be. Our hope is on the grace of God and on His mercy. Furthermore, Peter will use a word that is often a word in the Old Testament, and that is simply in verse 18, know that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers. We're no longer hopelessly chained as slaves. We've been ransomed. We've been purchased back out of that. We've been purchased back from a life of futility because of what Christ has done for us. He will also say that we have been born of imperishable seed in verse 23. And he makes a big deal out of that. Actually, you know, a little bit further back in the book earlier in chapter 1, he talks about that which is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. Things won't wear out. Our houses won't need to be repainted. They won't fall apart. The rooms that God has prepared for us, they're going to stay that way. They're going to be pristine always. Our bodies are not going to wear out. I don't know if when we get there, we're going to be what we looked like when we were younger. That's possible. You know, we're going to get whole new bodies. You know, just let your imagination run a little bit with that. There, it's unfading, undefiled, and imperishable. That's what we have laid up for us. And if that's not enough, Peter will remind them also that God's Word is something that abides forever. And that Word, we are told in verse 25, is the good news that was preached to you. So you see, Peter is hopeful. Maybe he thinks it's all of those things will kind of stir them up, like the guys on the road to Emmaus got stirred up by the hope of the gospel and by the hope that these things were really true. And so you see, maybe there's some way that we kind of are kind of stirred up a little bit ourselves to be reminded, you know what? No matter what happens in this life, we have set our hope on the grace of God and the mercy of God and the loving kindness of God that is so much a part of a reflection of God as He's revealed in the Old Testament. The writer in the book of Hebrews reminds us that we should look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross. Why could Jesus go through that cross? Why could He go through that struggle and suffering? He looked ahead. And you know, there's joy on the other side of this. And that's really what we're called to do. It's what hope Peter, I think, is trying to stir up in his audience. What do we do in the present must reflect what goal we want to attain in the future. As I've already said, in this case, the future is the salvation of our souls. Well, what does Peter suggest that we do in the present to get us to where we want to be in the future? Well, he expresses that in a couple of different ways, not the least of which is what he says in verse 13. He expresses our course of action, number one, in terms of readiness. We have to be ready to serve God. Listen to what he says here. Preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Prepare your minds for action. You always have to be ready. You know, we've spent a great deal of time in the last couple of weeks talking about what's going on inside of our minds and maybe thinking about what is happening and focusing on our thoughts. We're going to spend the next couple of months talking about it from a positive perspective. But you see, that's a part of what Peter's talking about here. Focus your mind on being prepared. And there are just some ways that I think we can do that in ourselves to get us to the point where we are, in fact, ready. I think more importantly, though, Peter talks in terms of reflecting in our lives the holiness of God. Then in verse 16, "You shall be holy, for I am holy." Peter draws that directly out of the Old Testament, by the way. I believe it's from the book of Leviticus, where the people in Israel were told to be holy because that's the way God is. And so one of the ways that Peter tells us to kind of be moving toward the goal and what we can is simply to reflect the holiness of God. Now, I think he gets very specific about that here in one very real case, and that is over in verse 22. He says, "Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart." I don't know if we kind of get tired of hearing about, well, we're supposed to love one another. You know, the world has a way of taking a good statement and making it something that is really different. But it still can be true that love really is the critical element in our relationship to one another. In John chapter 13, in verse 35, Jesus says, "People will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." And maybe we really shouldn't underestimate just how powerful it is for people to see that we really, maybe I should even say it, maybe we just really kind of like each other. You know? Really have a feeling that we have an attachment to one another. And we attempt in every way that we can to show that love to one another by treating each other in a loving way. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 8, it defines how we're supposed to react to one another in love by saying, love is patient, love is kind, and maybe you even know all the rest of the words, but you know, love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Well, isn't it great that the one way that we can demonstrate our preparedness to the goal of salvation of our souls is simply we are called to love each other. That's a powerful statement. Let's not underestimate just how powerful the love that we show to one another is in terms of our getting to our goal, but not only that, but our witness to those who are around us. Think about how God showed His love for us. Romans chapter 5 and verse 8. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. A lot of blots in our souls. A lot of things that maybe make us don't feel very lovable or seem very lovable, but you know, God still loves us. And He simply calls us to do the same. Love plays a role in what we do today, as well as what effect it has on the future, on our goal. Conclude with a couple of questions. Do we have a fix on where we're going? Well, we know one thing for sure. The goal of our lives is the salvation of our souls. What we do in the present has to be consistent with what it takes to get there. What do we want as a church? Well, maybe what we do in the present has to be consistent with how we get there. Do we have a hopeful future? With the message of the gospel, don't we always? If there's anything I believe that's going to stir us up, it's just going to be to remind ourselves that that message of the gospel is one of hope. Hope beyond sometimes what we see happening in the present, because we can see the future, because we have our eyes fixed on what's coming next. Are we serving only ourselves? Nope. We always have in mind those who are going to cross the bridge after us. Now, we've seen a lot in the last couple of months about the bridges and how they're kind of falling apart in different places of the country. And Jan and I have gone down Route 95 a few times, and there's several times in the last couple of months they've been repairing the bridges and diverting traffic, and it's just a pain. But you have to look at those, because you got to be concerned about people who are going to pass them after you. Even if I were never to pass that bridge, maybe it's important for me to do something to that bridge so that the people who come after me are going to be able to cross over that bridge. That's kind of part of what we live to do, isn't it? That we always keep that in mind. Who's coming after us? Let's be hopeful for the future because of the gospel. Let's follow the prophets of old by serving not just ourselves, but those who are going to come after us. I'd like to think this is an encouraging message. Peter is trying to encourage his members. If we only will be encouraged and be reminded of the grace of God and all the good things that we have, maybe that kind of helps us keep going. Maybe it stirs us up. Maybe that kind of gets that fire in our bones once again, even if things don't seem to be going real well in our lives for one reason or another. Be encouraged by the gospel today. Accept the gospel today and serve God faithfully. It will, in fact, give you a sense of future hope.